Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. Presented by Belco Credit Union. Visit www.belco.org/authors.asp to learn more about how Belco can help you. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
I just want to first welcome you to the Tattered Cover Bookstore, and thank you all for turning out tonight. And also thank you for coming out to support your independent and local businesses, because it really does make a difference. For tonight, I just want to say a couple quick words to introducing tonight's author. I know many of you probably already know tonight's author, either through his insightful reporting at the Washington Post, which he's been doing since 1994. I've been reading some of the pieces since the early 2000s, especially from his pieces from Baghdad and then now from Afghanistan. Or you may know him from his earlier book, The Imperial Life in the Emerald City, which looked at the Americans in the Green Zone in Iraq after the invasion in 2003. And like that book, tonight's book, Little America, really does look at that intersection of, boy, how does the military and the diplomatic team and all these different American forces come together to make decisions and then make policy on the fly as they're looking at working in then Iraq, then now in Afghanistan. So without further ado, I just want to introduce our tonight's author, Rajiv Chandrasekharvin.
I can safely attest that it's easier to get to Kandahar than it is to Denver from Washington. I spent the whole day on a plane today. Sorry I'm late. I wound up discovering that the path to Denver leads through Cleveland and multiple weather and United Airlines delays. So my apologies. I'd like to start out with sort of a confession. I didn't want to write this book. When I set out for my first trip to Afghanistan in early 2009, I assumed that if there was a book to be written about the Afghan war, it would be about how President Obama and his team managed to reverse years of strategic drift over there and neglect and turn around a failing war, how they managed to, snatch a victory from the proverbial jaws of defeat. After spending 2 years in Iraq watching President Bush's merry band of neocons try to rebuild Iraq and transplant Jeffersonian democracy, and picking people more for political fidelity than subject matter expertise. I mean, they would ask people at the Pentagon who wanted to go out to Baghdad for their views on things like Roe versus Wade and capital punishment, for instance. I expected Team Obama to be different about this, to show us what can happen when the pros are put in charge of reconstruction during and after a conflict. I wasn't thinking naively that we'd somehow get peace a la Germany or Japan after World War II, or the Jeffersonian democracy that the neocons so foolishly thought they could birth in Iraq. But I was hopeful that the U.S. and its NATO partners would be able to return Afghanistan to where it was in late 2001 and early 2002, before we took our eye off the ball to invade Iraq. And that was a country where, the Taliban were on the run and a brighter future seemed a certainty. While I was on that first trip in 2009, President Obama decided to send an additional 17,000 troops to the warfront. For Obama, Afghanistan had been the good war, the war that began with two fallen towers, not faulty intelligence and bogus claims of WMD. Back in August 2007, when he was running for the presidency, then-Senator Obama had called Afghanistan the war that has to be won, and he pledged to deploy more troops and increase reconstruction assistance. And he vowed not to repeat the mistakes of the past when we turned our back on Afghanistan. Obama and his advisors assumed that first tranche of 17,000 troops would be enough to satisfy the Pentagon. And soon after approving those new troops, the president signed off on a new strategy document designed to guide the military in the use of those additional forces and those that were already on the ground. Obama made clear in that document that he signed in the spring of 2009 that his aims in Afghanistan and Pakistan were going to be clear and focused, to disrupt, dismantle, and defeat al-Qaeda. But the strategy to achieve that goal was going to be expansive. instead of focusing simply on killing or capturing Al-Qaeda leaders, the new White House plan envisaged building an Afghan state that would be strong and stable enough to withstand the possibility that some of those Al-Qaeda leaders would leave their sanctuaries in Pakistan and try to return back to Afghanistan. And that involved doing what the Americans should have done back in 2001, building an Afghan government, training a new army, providing essential services to the Afghan people. But with the Taliban in control of large swaths of the country, trying to pull that off in 2009 under Obama's watch was going to be much more difficult than it could have been back in 2002 and 2003. To do so, the military said it would have to implement what it called a counterinsurgency strategy. And the military abbreviates this with the phrase COIN. And COIN concentrates not on hunting down the bad guys, but using your military resources to actually protect the good people of the country you're trying to secure. And the thought is that by concentrating your forces on ensuring security for the civilian population, you'll deprive the insurgency of the popular support it needs to expand. But doing that requires resources, troops, and money, and it requires a lot of time. And it requires an awful lot of things to be done on the ground. It means it involves ensuring law and order, providing basic services like health care and education, setting up government operations, mentoring local security forces, rebuilding infrastructure. It sounded ambitious, and sure was. But remember, Afghanistan was the good war. And for Obama, the price tag back then didn't seem all that high. He thought he had already paid for much of it with that 17,000 troop approval. Of course, as you all know, that wasn't enough for the military. The new top military commander in Kabul, General Stan McChrystal, soon would ask the president for 40,000 more troops. And he told the president that if U.S. forces and NATO forces failed to reverse Taliban momentum within a year, that defeating the insurgency would no longer be possible. He bluntly told the president that the status quo would lead to failure. McChrystal's request back in 2009 led to a form of sticker shock in the White House. All of a sudden, this COIN strategy that the president had so quickly signed off on after taking office had a new price tag, more than 100,000 total U.S. troops on the ground. So as a result, the president convened a series of lengthy strategy sessions to evaluate McChrystal's request. Those in uniform, McChrystal, General Dave Petraeus, who was then the chief of the U.S. Central Command, Admiral Mike Mullen, then chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, all argued that it was essential that more forces be sent to Afghanistan. They argued that counterinsurgency was what had turned around Iraq, even though if you look at the real dynamics of why things changed in Baghdad, and I'd argue that turnaround may be too strong of a word given that just a few days ago 100 Iraqis were killed in a series of coordinated attacks. But nevertheless, violence levels have dropped there over the past few years from their heights. But the reasons for it involved more than just the addition of U.S. forces. But they argued to the president that more troops were critical in Iraq and would be critical in Afghanistan. But in Afghanistan, using those surge troops was more complicated than simply putting them in as referees between two sides of a civil war, as we did in Baghdad. In Afghanistan, it involved something far more complex, trying to convince the majority ethnic Pashtun population to cast their lot with President Hamid Karzai's government, to essentially stop supporting the Taliban or to get off the fence of ambivalence and say, we support our government. The problem was that Karzai's administration was often more rapacious and corrupt than the Taliban. And so there's a real question that emerged. How could COIN work when the locals were turning to the insurgents to protect them from their supposed protectors? The other thing about COIN is that it required a lot of patience. It can take years before a besieged civilian population feels safe enough to demonstrate allegiance to its government. But commanders sort of downplayed these risks and costs. Civilians in the War Cabinet, particularly civilian advisors to the president and the White House, were not sold on McChrystal's plan, and a number of them argued against it. The chief among them was Vice President Biden. And he doubted whether President Hamid Karzai would be truly supportive of our counterinsurgency strategy, and he questioned whether the Pakistanis would take meaningful steps to crack down on insurgent sanctuaries on their soil. Situation room sessions, he kept probing and prodding military leaders when they argued in favor of counterinsurgency. And at one point, he sent a memo that he wrote directly to Obama. And I, in the reporting for this book, I managed to get my paws on this. It had never been revealed before. And I just want to, it's one, I want to read you one paragraph from it. Biden wrote to Obama in the fall of 2009, "I do not see how anyone who took part in our discussions could emerge without profound questions about the viability of counterinsurgency. Our military will do its part. They will clear anything we ask them to clear. They will hold anything we ask them to hold. But no one can tell you with conviction when, and even if, we can produce the flip sides of coin that are required to build and transfer responsibility to the Afghans. An effective and sustainable civilian surge, a credible partner in Kabul, basic governance and services, and competent Afghan security forces. We simply can't control these variables, yet they're essential to the success of COIN. In the end, Obama sided with his commanders. He decided to give them almost all of what they wanted, 30,000 more troops. The surge did come with conditions. The most significant of those was that the troops would start coming home within 2 years, a deadline that he took from the military's own planning documents that said that areas could be cleared of insurgents and handed over to the Afghans within 18 to 24 months. A month after all of this, in January 2010, I was preparing to accompany the first wave of surge troops as they were going to, there's a plan to assault a Taliban stronghold in southern Helmand province. It was a place called Marja. It was a nasty place. There were hundreds of insurgents holed up there, dozens of bomb-making factories. The fields were largely, farmers' fields were largely growing opium-producing poppies, the sales of which were being used to fund the insurgency. And in my office in Washington, as I sort of gazed over this area on Google Earth, I noticed something very odd. You know, southern Afghanistan is sort of the land of, you know, mud brick huts and kind of meandering farm plots. It looks nothing like Colorado as you fly over it with nicely, you know, demarcated farmers' fields. Everything sort of meanders around because people don't use, you know, traditional surveying instruments to sort of delineate the borders of their fields. But here in Marja, there were these what looked like irrigation canals, razor sharp as the avenues of Manhattan going north-south. And I said, huh, I wonder who built that. Well, it turns out the answer wasn't all that hard to find. It was in the Library of Congress and the National Archives and in the files at the U.S. Agency for International Development. And it was on the internet. And I would soon discover that it was a story suffused with relevant lessons for our latest attempt at nation building. But few in official Washington had bothered to read about it or connect the dots. And it's a story that, quite remarkably, begins with the Holocaust. In the mid-1930s, as Jewish fur traders were forced to flee Nazi advances in Central Europe, many of them came to the United States and many of them settled in New York. And they needed a new source for pelts. So they turned, quite remarkably, to Afghanistan, whose hills abounded with the Persian fat-tailed sheep. The fleece of the newborn lambs could be turned into lustrous coats and hats. And in the late 30s and early 40s, Afghanistan exported to the United States between 1 and 2 million caracol wool pelts a year. The sale of each one of these pelts, because of currency exchange controls, put a few more dollars in the Afghan king's treasury. So at the end of World War II, as Europe was digging out of its rubble, Afghanistan was sitting on a comparative windfall. It had $100 million in gold and foreign exchange reserves in its treasury. And so the young 32-year-old king in Kabul, Mohammad Zahir Shah, who had been very impressed with what the United States had done in the Tennessee Valley during the Great Depression, thought to himself, I would like to transform the barren desert that lines the Helmand River in southern Afghanistan into a verdant agricultural oasis. I'd like to turn this into a breadbasket for my country to feed my people and to vault my primitive landlocked nation into the modern age. So he used his own country's money to hire an American company called Morrison Knudsen, a large engineering firm that had built the Hoover Dam and the San Francisco Bay Bridge. And in the late 40s and early 50s, dozens of American engineers went to southern Afghanistan to dig irrigation canals and build dams. It was part of a grand project, not just at agricultural development, but also in social engineering. At that point, the Afghan king had a handful of advisors who had spent a few years studying in America, and they wanted to bring the America that had sort of dazzled them in their school days to Afghanistan. They wanted to build new villages with modern schools and health clinics. They wanted to resettle nomads. They wanted to have people from different tribes living next to one another rather than in separate villages. They wanted women to sort of cast off burqas, and they wanted eye for an eye Islamic justice to be replaced with written laws. They wanted professional government men from Kabul to replace the gray-bearded elders who wielded power in the provinces. And they saw in these American engineers the ideal partners to transform their nation. Well, the agricultural project soon ran aground. It turns out that the soil in the southern Helmand Valley is very salty. And when Afghan farmers flood their fields, which is how they tended to irrigate, the water would evaporate and make the soil even saltier, sort of stunting anything that's grown over there. And so early on, this effort really failed to yield its promised hopes. When the Afghans started to develop reservations, of course, the American contractor said, the answer is simple here. We simply need to do more. We need to build a bigger dam, a bigger reservoir, dig more canals, and, oh, by the way, it'll cost you more money. We soon depleted the Afghan treasury, forcing the Afghans to come hat in hand to Washington for loans and then eventually outright U.S. foreign assistance, and would begin a decades-long cycle of Americans pouring in lots and lots of taxpayer money trying to build parts of Afghanistan. But while all this was going on, and while these Afghans who had come traveled all the way across the country to the south with the hopes of getting new farmland sort of sat in tent camps watching their new fields turn into marshes, the American engineers who had also been living in camps decided, you know, they would at least try to move forward with the social engineering aspects of this great experiment. So they decided to create for themselves a town where they would live, not just a camp. And so they built an 8-square-block community with suburban-style tract homes. You know, if any of you have seen National Geographic pictures of Afghanistan, every home has big, tall walls around it for privacy. This was going to be like America, homes where neighbors could look into one another's property, manicured green front lawns. They set up the country's first and only co-ed swimming pool, a high school where boys and girls studied together, a clubhouse where you could get a gin and tonic in the evenings. There were nightly card games and weekly square dances. This was going to be a model town that the Afghans would look at and aspire to create for themselves. Well, of course, the rural, traditional, conservative community over there looked at this and said, yeah, it's fine for the Americans, but we don't really want it for ourselves. But they did come up with a name for the place. They started to call it Little America. And that's where I get the title for my book from. You know, as the irrigation project began to get more troubled, eventually the Afghan government decided to end its contracts with Morrison Knudsen, and then soon thereafter, the U.S. Agency for International Development stepped in 1961, right after it was created by President Kennedy, and it soon became one of the largest foreign endeavors for USAID. And they soon discovered that there was just a basic fatal flaw in this project. The canal had been built too low to the ground, and the water didn't have enough force to run off the fields. The fields weren't really flat. There weren't enough drainage ditches. So the American engineers in the 1960s came up with what they thought was going to be a simple solution. Move the Afghans off their land, bring in some bulldozers, flatten the land, welcome the Afghans back. But the Afghans were petrified that if they were moved off the land, they'd never get it back. So when the American bulldozers came in, the Afghans met them with rifles. And so began a years-long process of trying to fix it and not being able to. Finally, in 1974, money ran out, project ended. And then 3 months later, Henry Kissinger happened to stop off in Kabul on a trip to India. And the Afghan prime minister complained to him that the Helmand Valley project was an unfinished symphony. And Kissinger said, we'll get on it. We'll come up with a solution. And this time, the task fell to a tiny federal agency that actually might well be known in Colorado. It fell to the U.S. Soil Conservation Service. And they came up with what was a maddeningly simple solution. Simply give the Afghans hand tools to dig their own drainage ditches. And on the first few farms that this was implemented on, yields increased by 75% within a year. But what happened? Within a year, there was a communist coup in Afghanistan. Soviet tanks rolled in. Every American left Little America. We had finally found an answer to the problems that had bedeviled us for decades, but it was too late. Had senior officials at the White House and the Pentagon and the State Department bothered to understand any of this history back in 2009, I think it might have given them pause in advocating another grand attempt at nation building in Afghanistan. Instead, our government barreled forward with a strategy that had a slim chance of working. In my book, I dissect the American approach to stabilizing Afghanistan on two levels. The first is strategically. That is, did the coin strategy and the surge, was it the right decision? The second is operationally. Once President Obama signed off on the coin strategy and approved the surge, how well did the organs of our government, did the Pentagon, the State Department, USAID, even Obama's own White House, how well did they implement his policy? Let's start with strategy. And let me state up front that I believe coin can work if the conditions are right and the cost is merited. But for coin to prevail in Afghanistan, several things needed to occur. The Afghan government had to be a willing partner. The Pakistani government had to crack down on insurgent sanctuaries. The U.S. government had to be willing to commit troops and money for years on end. The American people had to be patient enough for security to improve gradually over years. And finally, the Afghan army had to be ready and willing to assume control of areas that were cleared with American blood and sweat. COIN, in my view, failed on all of those fronts. First, let's talk about the Afghan government. President Karzai never agreed with our war strategy. U.S. officers and diplomats correctly argue that it is tribal rivalries and inequitable distribution of power at the local level and Karzai's government's failure to provide even the most basic services to his population that are all factors that are pushing Afghans into the arms of the Taliban. But Karzai doesn't see it that way. He doesn't believe his government's corrupt or inefficient. He thinks the problem is simply infiltration of bad guys from Pakistan. And while that is a problem, it's not the only problem. So he thought what we should do is put all of our troops on the border with Pakistan. By going into the villages of Kandahar and Helmand and trying to build governments and trying to provide services, he thought we were simply mucking around with what he sees as a self-regulating system of tribal governance. And so he was never a partner in our efforts there. The Afghan people had a different reason to be skeptical of COIN. You know, contrary to the images we see on television here, the Afghan people have no great love for the Taliban. They see them as the zealots they are. These guys have lived under the Taliban, and they have no great love for them. But you know what? They don't like their government either. They see the Afghan government for what it is, you know, an administration that's filled with some thugs and warlords and corrupt scoundrels. They abuse the people, shake them down for bribes, kidnap young boys for their pleasure. And so when American troops told the Afghans, hey, we're coming here to provide security so your government can come and help you, they said, whoa, wait a second. We may not like the Taliban, but we don't want our government here either. You know, in many ways, Afghanistan is like the American West. There's sort of a love-hate relationship with Washington. You want Washington to provide certain services, but you don't want Washington breathing down your neck at every twist and turn. And unfortunately, Washington failed to grasp that with regard to Afghanistan. The Pakistani government, early on in 2001 and 2, the Pakistanis provided a degree of sanctuary to the Taliban, but refrained from overt assistance to them, weren't not providing them weapons or intelligence. But by mid-2009, as American surge forces were flowing in, the Pakistani intelligence service, the ISI, adopted a far more hands-on strategy. Using civilian intermediaries, they started meeting more directly with Taliban commanders, started providing them intelligence, and started providing them, through cutouts and intermediaries, additional munitions, particularly higher-grade military explosives. What about the price tag? Was it worth it? You know, it costs roughly $1 million a year to keep one U.S. service member in Afghanistan. That means that the annual tab for our war last year was about $100 billion. Is achieving a marginally less bad outcome in Afghanistan worth that expense? With other pressing security challenges, Iran, North Korea, political upheaval in the Middle East, is it prudent to be tying up so many forces and dispersing so many precious dollars in remote Afghan villages? The surge has also exhausted our patience as a nation. You know, the war was in its eighth year when Obama decided to surge. And even though many Americans shared the president's view that Afghanistan was the good war, only a slim majority of our countrymen supported the surge decision. Now, although commanders-in-chief shouldn't use public opinion polling to guide strategic decisions, public support is essential for any drawn-out campaign involving tens of thousands of troops, hundreds of monthly casualties, and almost daily fatalities. Had all the other factors played out differently, had Karzai been a true partner, had the Pakistanis taken meaningful action against the Taliban, and had our nation not been in the throes of economic crisis, then perhaps the American people could have rallied around such a large war effort. But when all of those indicators started pointing down, public opinion soon followed. Now the latest public opinion polling shows that even a majority of registered Republicans don't think the war is worth fighting. And lastly, the question of the Afghan army. Instead of compelling Afghan soldiers into action, the surge in many cases sent the opposite message. The Afghans often decided to hang back and let the Americans do the fighting. What was supposed to be a kick in the pants, or at least a golden opportunity to work in tandem with U.S. forces, turned into a crutch. But lest you think I'm all about the negative, the Afghan army has emerged as a rare bright spot in this overall effort. Yes, the army's still raggedy. It's still beset by ethnic rivalries and tribal factions. But as American troops start to leave, the Afghans are stepping up in small ways to shoulder more of the fighting. And through it all, the Afghan army remains the country's most respected institution. If Afghanistan hangs together post-2014, when U.S. combat forces depart, it's going to be because of the Afghan army. So what should the president have done back in 2009? Well, I'm not one of those who thinks we should have simply packed up and left. Had we done that, it likely would have condemned the Afghans to the hell of a prolonged insurgency or another civil war. We still have a moral obligation to the Afghan people. You know, when we launched the war in 2001, we made an implicit promise to them that if they stood with us against the Taliban, we'd give them a shot at a better, freer life. But did that require a coin strategy and a surge that tired us out? One of the main characters in my book, a State Department officer named Cale Weston, who had spent 7 years between Iraq and Afghanistan, more time in the war zones than any other U.S. Foreign Service officer, argued that instead of going big with a surge or packing it in and going home, we should have gone long. The president needed to determine how many troops he was willing to commit to Afghanistan for 10 years or more, and then he needed to pledge that level of support to the Afghan people. That likely would have meant no surge, and it probably would have meant fewer troops than were deployed back then in 2009. But Cale Weston was convinced that a smaller but enduring force would be smarter on all fronts. It would appeal to the Afghans, who chafed at the presence of so many foreign soldiers on their soil. It would compel the Afghan army to more quickly assume responsibility for fighting the Taliban and securing the population. And it would force the Americans to focus only on the most essential missions instead of grand nation-building efforts. Afghanistan, he often said, is a marathon, not a sprint. The surge was a sprint, and we got winded too quickly. Despite all the coin assumptions that turned out to be false, our troops have made remarkable progress in the past 3 years. Parts of southern Afghanistan that were once teeming with insurgents are now largely peaceful. Schools have reopened, as have bazaars. People are living as close to a normal life as possible. But Afghanistan as a whole is not fully secure. Eastern parts of the country are still in the grip of a Taliban faction backed by the Pakistani intelligence service. And in the south, a critical question lingers. Will the Afghans, will their government, will their army, will their police, will they have the willingness and ability to take the baton from American troops as they begin coming home? Will the Afghans sustain the gains? Will all of the blood and treasure we have expended there have been worth it? Or will Afghanistan slip back to chaos? Look, I don't think the Talibs are going to be able to roll into Kabul with the same ease as they did in the 1990s. I don't think the Kabul government's going to fall like Saigon's did. The Afghan army, I think, is going to be able to hold on to major cities and other critical areas. But the insurgents will almost certainly expand control of rural districts and valleys, and they'll retain the ability to conduct frequent attacks against government and civilian targets. The foreseeable future there is going to be messy and chaotic. but many Americans may well see it as good enough. Osama's dead, Al-Qaeda's on the ropes, the Talib leadership has taken a beating. But could all of that have occurred without a big surge? Could we have achieved a similar messy but good enough outcome without hundreds more dead Americans and thousands more gravely wounded? Before I take your questions, I want to turn very quickly to the issue of how the surge was executed. I've talked about the strategic disconnect. Now I want to address operational failures. Agree or disagree, the surge was the president's strategy, and the government beneath him had an obligation to make their best efforts to implement it. But each part of our government, I discovered in the reporting for this book, made critical errors. The Pentagon sent too many troops to the wrong places. So you would think, if your first wave of troops, you'd send them to the areas in and around Kandahar. It was the country's second largest city, the spiritual capital for the Taliban. It was the city that the Taliban were focusing on, and in 2009 was a genuine risk of falling to the Taliban. And if the insurgents had seized it, they'd have a springboard to seize much of the rest of the country, like they did in the 1990s. But instead of sending the majority of the first wave of our additional forces to Kandahar, we sent them to neighboring Helmand province, to a part of the country, a desert, that was home to fewer than 1% of the population. Why, you might ask? Because of tribal rivalries, not in Afghanistan, but in the Pentagon. That first wave of forces, the majority of that first wave of forces were U.S. Marines. U.S. Marines are great fighters. But the Marine leadership insisted that they wanted to bring their own helicopters, their own logistics teams, and to do this, they needed essentially their own patch of the desert. They didn't want to fight side by side with the U.S. Army and the Canadian Army in the areas in and around Kandahar City. So the only place could really be carved up and given to them was this patch of Helmand province. By doing so, they did great stuff in Helmand, but I question whether it had strategic value. And by putting them there, we squandered the first year of the troop surge. Civilian surge of diplomats and reconstruction workers. It was supposed to occur in tandem with the military surge to get American civilian experts down there at the sort of district village level to help build institutions of government, provide basic services to people. But instead of getting them all down in the field, two-thirds of the civilian surge, when they showed up, they also came about a year late. Two-thirds of them wound up stationed at the embassy complex in Kabul instead of getting out into the field. And many of them were simply writing memos and cables and doing other bureaucratic work over there that they could have just as easily done back in Washington. Look, there were a lot of talented American diplomats who got out there, but the entire surge effort was bedeviled by a lack of initiative and creativity back in Washington. You know, instead of scouring our nation for top talent to fill these jobs, those responsible for hiring first turned to State Department and USAID officers in other parts of the world, but many of them had already served multiple tours in Iraq and Afghanistan. So eventually they sought out retirees. We sent a 79-year-old man to the reconstruction team office in Kandahar. Eventually, aid decided to hire outsiders for these year-long posts, but the human resources team simply waited for resumes to come in over the transom, and many of them were from contractors who had worked on wasteful projects in Iraq. And so, you know, it was almost as embarrassing as that first year I chronicle in Iraq in my other book, when we sent, for instance, a son of a political donor who was 24 years old, who had no background in finance, to Baghdad with the job of reopening the stock exchange there. We sent a USAID field officer to one part of northern Helmand who showed up in high heels and got into a fight with the Marines when they wouldn't give her an air-conditioned trailer to live in. In the safest district of Helmand province, the State Department simply could not hold down a civilian rep. The first guy came and abruptly left. The second one did the same, but not before acknowledging that he didn't know the most commonly used acronym for the Afghan security forces. The third guy stayed, but it was only because he'd been fired from his job as a town manager in Virginia. Let's talk about USAID and money. Look, Afghanistan was really deserving of additional reconstruction assistance. It was shortchanged under the Bush administration. Think of Afghanistan, though, as a parched man on a hot day. Instead of giving him a big, tall glass of cold water, though, with the best of intentions, we turned a fire hose on him. more water than he could drink, and sort of wounding him in the process. In 2010, we tried to spend $4 billion on reconstruction in Afghanistan. That's B with a billion, on reconstruction in Afghanistan. In one district, that equated to more money than the per capita income from every man, woman, and child. Not surprisingly, it wound up exacerbating the very corruption we were trying to stem. And lastly, back in Washington, you know, the subtitle of this book is The War Within the War. There was a second war going on, and that was in our nation's capital. And one of the nastiest conflicts in that Washington war was a fight between Richard Holbrooke and the president's team in the White House. Holbrooke was a veteran diplomat who had been appointed by Secretary of State Clinton to be her point man for Afghanistan and Pakistan. And one of his principal assignments was to try to find a possible path to potential peace talks with some elements of the Taliban. It's not like they were kind of the Talibs were sitting there on the other side of the table waiting for peace talks, but trying to get there, particularly as we were going to be sending in more troops and having more leverage. Holbrooke was eminently qualified to do this. He had been a member of, at age 27, he was the youngest American to serve on the U.S. delegation to the Paris peace talks that were aimed at ending the Vietnam War. In 1996, he brokered the Dayton Accords, which ended the war in the Balkans. So he was a guy who had more experience with war and peace than anybody else at senior levels of the Obama administration. Well, he also had a giant ego, sharp elbows, a real thirst for the spotlight, and he alienated a lot of people, including President Karzai, the leaders of Pakistan, and annoyed a lot of people in the White House. He was the antithesis of Obama's no-drama rule. And so a number of the president's senior advisors instead sort of focused on his shortcomings and set out to sort of kind of screw with him at every twist and turn. They deprived him the use of military aircraft to fly out to Afghanistan. They excluded him from meetings. I recount one particularly shocking story in the book where President Karzai is coming for an Oval Office meeting, and they literally try to slip talking points to Obama so that the president doesn't realize, but they want the president to read, essentially belittling Holbrooke. The scheme is sort of foiled at the last minute by Clinton. But it got really nasty, really vicious and personal. And Obama could have put a stop to this, but he simply let both sides continue on this. It would have involved breaking a lot of China with Clinton if he had forced her to get rid of Holbrooke. But he never once either tried to get rid of Holbrooke or tell his team to follow Holbrooke. The result of this was that we squandered, you know, yet another year of the surge. A time when we had the most boots on the battlefield to try to aggressively explore negotiations and the war. You know, just in closing, you know, although more Americans perished on the beaches of Normandy and in the jungles of Vietnam, Afghanistan stands alone in the annals of American warfare. It's our country's longest war. It's a forgotten war. With no draft, the fighting's been left to a small cadre of professional officers and volunteer grunts. And I think it's by far the most complicated war our nation's prosecuted. Troops have been told to befriend villagers and bombard insurgents with the same fervor, often in the same day. Commanders have been ordered to fight with fewer forces and in less time than they wanted. Diplomats and development experts have been required to work in environments that were more dangerous than they signed up for. All told, I spent 3 years observing Americans attempting to defeat the insurgency in Afghanistan. For a long time, I thought we could pull it off if only we had enough people, money, and patience. But the real challenge wasn't headcounts, budgets, or public opinion. For all the grand pronouncements about waging a new kind of war, our nation was unable to adapt. Too few generals realized that surging forces could be counterproductive, that the presence of more foreign forces could be a potent recruiting tool in the Pashtun heartland. Too few soldiers were ordered to leave their air-conditioned bases and live among the people in fly-infested villages. Too few diplomats invested the time and effort to understand the languages and cultures of the places in which they were stationed. Too few development experts were interested in anything other than making a buck. Too few officials in Washington were willing to assume the risks necessary to forge a lasting peace. And nobody, it seemed, wanted to work together. The good war had turned bad. For years, we dwelled on the limitations of the Afghans. We should have focused on ours. Thank you. Before I take your questions, I have to explain why this wonderful can of faux French perfume was placed on the podium. Rodney Fury there served in Kandahar for a year, and he and I had the pleasure of traveling down to the town of Spin Boldak on the Afghan-Pakistan border. It defies explanation. So, there's a chapter in here in the start of the third section of the book called "The Boss of the Border," which, if you read it, you'll grasp the madness of Spin Boldak. And we went down together to spend a little time with this warlord who essentially runs the place. Who initially we tried to marginalize, then we tried to sort of mentor. And it's an interesting, complicated story of an Afghan power broker's evolving relationship with the United States and how it embodies our changing goals in Afghanistan. And I wouldn't have been able to tell it if not for his help. And as we were walking through the bazaar there, this warlord went up and decided to acquire for us cologne. I'd like to say that he paid for it, but he gets everything he wants down there for free. And you were so good to keep yours. I have no idea what I did with my can of this stuff. It's not something I'd ever wear. It shows just how wacky of an environment it is there, and how these power brokers can he could get pretty much anything he wanted, but he also was keen on making friends with those who came to visit him. So anyway, we can talk more about this or anything else you guys want to talk about. I'm sorry for filibustering so long here. I've come from Washington, and we love to talk at length, but I would love to entertain your questions. Yeah.
Do they share goals? Do they cooperate? Yeah. What motivates good. A person to join one or the other?
That's a good question. The question was, what's the difference between Al-Qaeda and the Taliban? Al-Qaeda is a narrower... rescind that word. I'm not saying narrower. It's a smaller organization that is more sophisticated, whose... what's remaining of its leadership is dedicated principally to transnational terrorist activities. They seek to continue to attack U.S. targets, U.S. interests, and those of our allies. The Taliban, by and large, have simply domestic aims, domestic Afghan aims. They want to turn Afghanistan back into sort of the Islamic Emirate, one where they go back to a world where religious education is compulsory. Men grow long beards. Women are forced to wear the burqa and are deprived of rights. Their goals in terms of trying to sort of project that power or influence beyond the borders of Afghanistan is, there isn't much evidence for that. Now, they were in league with Al-Qaeda. Sanctuary to Osama and the Taliban or the Al Qaeda leadership. Pardon me, in the late 90s and even after the 2001 attacks. But there's an interesting question now that the senior ranks of Al Qaeda have been so badly hit. Would the Taliban, if they were to take over parts of the country, would they welcome back in Al Qaeda, or have the Taliban moderated themselves? And some argue that the Taliban of today are not the Taliban of 10, 15 years ago. It's an open question, but look, Al-Qaeda, which is what is left of core Al-Qaeda, is largely in Pakistan. They have affiliates in Yemen and Somalia. There are very, very few Al-Qaeda operatives in Afghanistan, according to the CIA and other intelligence agencies. Al-Qaeda does a lot of wacky stuff, crazy, but fundamentally, they are rational actors, in my view. And if the marginal cost of doing business is greater in Afghanistan than in Pakistan, they're not going to move back to Afghanistan if they could. And in Pakistan, they enjoy relative sanctuary. Nobody's chasing after them. In Afghanistan, they'd be subjected to, not just drone strikes where they have in Pakistan, but special forces night raids, all sorts of other things. It's a harder environment for them to operate. And it would be a harder environment to operate even if we had 5,000 troops in Afghanistan. So I don't necessarily see core Al-Qaeda moving back to Afghanistan in droves, even in an environment where there were far, far fewer U.S. troops on the ground. In the green shirt back there?
Is it more damaging, do you think, to the U.S. government to just take their losses on this war and pull out?
Question was, is it more damaging to U.S. interests and U.S. reputation, perhaps,
financial
and political, to simply sort of cut losses right now versus, staying on the sort of glide slope that we are, which involves, 23,000 troops are in the process of coming out between now and the end of September. More troops likely will come out next year. And with getting to a point where all of our combat forces are out by the end of 2014, although still an open question, I'm sure the Pentagon would like to keep some special forces there to conduct counterterrorism missions beyond 2014. So either go that glide slope or say, all right, let's try to get them out as fast as possible within 3 or 6 months. I think just like that, the story of Little America that I tell in Chapter 1, where we finally kind of get it right, but it's too late, I think we're actually on a path to what is a reasonable effort here over the next couple of years to try to sort of build up an Afghan army that can be multi-ethnic, that can try to sort of serve as the protector of the nation state, to try to build now, to step away from some of these cockamamie efforts at building little governments and villages and valleys, but trying to build up at least some of the core functions of a national government. So trying to keep Afghanistan from really imploding, but not trying to create the sort of ideal that we were trying to do back in 2009.
But that you can go and should interfere out of your boundaries. What is the rest of the world getting wrong that is so unacceptable to the American people? Putting the violence aside for a second.
Well, look, I think the Afghans actually would like a degree of sustained international assistance. Now, they have a very ambivalent relationship when it comes to foreign forces. On one hand, they're patriotic people who chafe at the presence of international troops, but they also recognize that, they don't want the Taliban back, nor do they like their own government, and they have doubts about their own security forces. And so it's more complicated than simply the Afghans saying, we don't want these guys, and it's not a mission today that is simply the Americans jamming everything down their throats. It was to a degree. There were elements of that a year ago, 2 years ago. I think we've become slightly more humble about this. If we were to just pack up and go tomorrow, I think there is a much higher likelihood that the whole thing would collapse. And the question is, after all that has been spent there, all those lives, some people might say, how much good do you throw after bad? But another way to look at this is, for all that's been sacrificed, is a commitment of a modest additional amount of resources to improve your odds of trying to hold on to some of what has been achieved better than simply saying, all of this is totally, totally screwed up. And that sort of depends on how you game out what happens after 2014. And is this totally going to go, in the toilet? Or is there a chance that at least major cities will hold and some of what has been done will be achieved? And I happen to be of the latter camp. So I think that a modest commitment of resources probably makes sense, but not the status quo. And it needs to get to a point where really the emphasis is on civilian assistance, not on large footprint military presence. And there's a real open question there. What will our commitment be to providing that necessary assistance as troops start coming home? Over here.
This is a bit of a hypothetical question, but what happens if Romney wins? Mm-hmm. What?
That's a very good question. The question was, what might happen in Afghanistan if Romney were to win, Romney has affirmed that he wants combat forces to depart by the end of 14, which is what all the NATO member states have signed up for. Yesterday at the VFW speech. Yes, he did. Yeah, recently. But he hasn't said... Well, but he hasn't said much about it, so this is more than he said today. Yes. That's it. So, but between now and then, I think there is an open question there. Some of his advisors would like to see another big push next year, but as I noted earlier, now a majority of Republicans don't support, continued fighting there. So the question is going to be, is he going to be willing to go against his base and try to sort of have one big last push? And the question here is also not just the Republican base. Will the Afghan government want to entertain another mini surge or even a reduction of drawdowns? And that could be actually quite controversial in Afghanistan, and it would be harder for him to pull off if the Afghans say, we don't really support this. Over here.
In listening to you, I couldn't help but think, do you think the Afghan army will support the Afghan government?
It's a good question. He's asking, will the Afghan army support the Afghan government? Again, an open question, but this is going to sound really out there, totally controversial, completely undemocratic, but if the Afghan army actually decides to sort of step up as the tool of unified nationhood and the guarantor of sovereignty, and not be used as a tool by bickering political factions, that's probably a good thing. Now, that sort of takes you away from Western notions of civilian control of the military. It starts to sound a little like Pakistan or maybe Turkey way back when or Egypt, and you say, oh, maybe that's dangerous. But if you look at places like Pakistan, yes, we were all concerned when the military steps in and, you know, does its soft coups. But you could also argue that the military has acted as a stabilizing force to some degree when you've got really dysfunctional political elements in charge. And if the Afghan army can actually rise above politics and see itself as the army for the nation, that would be great. The real worry is whether those political leaders and warlords and others will seek to pull the army apart for their own personal purposes in a chaotic post-2014 environment. As everybody's trying to sort of safeguard their interests, they will seek to sort of grab elements of the military as their own. And if that happens, that's a very, you know, worrying development for the future of the country. Anyway, thank you all for coming tonight.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fode, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Authors on Tour Live has been presented by Belco Credit Union. Belco has been serving members' financial needs since 1936. Visit www.belco.org/authors.asp to learn more about how Belco can help you. Stay pod-tuned in the coming weeks for many more authors as we podcast Authors on Tour.